Hi, Wanju. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Curb. I'm Andrew F. Pierce, and this is the podcast where I bring you in-depth interviews with filmmakers, creatives, and curators of culture. This podcast is recorded in Boorloo, Western Australia. Sovereignty never ceded. I remember sitting in the Mercury Theatre at the Adelaide Film Festival last year and watching Unspoken and getting to see a rare talent emerge on screen in the form of Kat Dominus. Her lead performance left me moved, shaken, and stunned by the depth of emotions she presented on screen. As the credits rolled, I saw that she was the co-writer of this award-winning short film, a credit she shares with Mariana Rudan and director Damien Walsh Howling. Unspoken is a story about family, it's a story about division, and it's a story built on intergenerational trauma. Kat plays Marina, a Croatian-born young woman living with her family in 1979. She's in a secret relationship with a white Aussie man, with the two keeping the relationship hidden from her parents. Marina's brothers also live under the same house, with the two brothers falling into the political unrest that unfurls on the streets of Sydney in the form of protests and demonstrations. Acting as a thematic layer to Unspoken is the true story of the Croatian Six. Six Croatian-Australian men who were sentenced to 15 years jail in 1981 for a conspiracy to bomb several sites in Sydney. Much of the evidence that was used in that trial of the Croatian Six was fabricated, with the men being set up as part of a sting operation by the Yugoslav Foreign Intelligence Service. The weight of this event sits in the background of Unspoken, with tensions emerging throughout the film between family members, between Croatian Australians and white Australians, and between a girlfriend and a boyfriend. Underpinning this tension is that central stunning performance from Kat Dominus, who commands the screen with a guiding, lived-in understanding of the weight of her characters' lives and the societal and political upheaval they're undergoing. As Marina, Kat presents the conflicted nature of wanting to fit into a new culture while also trying to navigate the familial heritage of a homeland's culture. In this regard, Unspoken becomes a universal story that many migrant families can relate to, especially from the frequently xenophobic landscape of Australian culture and society. These notions and a lot more are explored in this expansive interview with Kat, recorded ahead of Unspoken screening at the St Kilda Film Festival on 7th of June 2025. Unspoken has screened nationally across Australia and also took home the Grand Prix at the Clermont-Ferrand Short Film Festival earlier this year, a rare achievement for an Australian film. Less prestigious but notable still is that Unspoken featured in my personal Best Australian Films of 2024 list, and I'll stick a link to those in the show notes. It marks the grand arrival of actor-turned-director Damien Walsh Howling, of producer and co-writer Mariana Rudan, and of course Kat Dominus as actor, co-writer and producer. It's a stunning filmic achievement, and one that I cannot heap enough praise on. I absolutely love this film. I also love this conversation, and I hope that you do too. But before that, I want to encourage you to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Blue Sky at The Curb AU. We are a completely independent and ad-free website, lives on support of listeners and readers just like yourself. And if you can, visit patreon.com/TheCurbAU, where you can support our work from as little as $1 a month. If you're unable to financially support us, then please consider sharing this interview with your podcast-loving friends. We'd also love it if you could rate and review us on the podcast player of your choice. Each review helps amplify the interviews and stories to a wide audience. Right, it's enough of me talking. Here's the trailer for the St Kilda Film Festival, followed by my chat with Kat Dominus. Where did your interest in filmmaking and storytelling on screen come from?
Well, I was always really interested in film and plays and movies when I was little, like very young, under like six. And I used to write my own little plays and force my cousins and my siblings into these Christmas plays once a year, where no one wanted to participate but me. And I would do the whole thing. I'd direct it. I'd be Mrs. Claus. I'd set dress. And it was quite funny. And the parents would just, you know, laugh and watch. But moving into a little bit more of a older age, I just loved film. It just made me feel alive. And I actually never had the courage to pursue it until I was a lot later. So I did a full psych degree with health sciences and jumped into acting at 24, much later. But the drive and the passion behind film was always there. And then a funny story was I watched Twilight when I was a teenager, and I just thought it was like the worst film ever directed because I was a big fan of the books. But I just had this moment in my head, and I didn't direct Unspoken, but I just thought I can make a better movie than that. Surely if she can get that on the ground, then anyone can.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, it is actually really interesting to know the impact of Twilight and how it's kind of had a layered impact on people who have read the books, watched the film and gone, yeah, this is really bad. I know that the team behind Lesbian Space Princess, also really influenced by Twilight in different ways. It's fascinating to see the impact of that film.
It's enraged a whole generation.
Well, I guess, I mean, the book means something, right? Mm. You get yourself attached to the book, and then you have this notion, you've made this film in your mind, and then you sit down and watch it, and it's not what you wanted.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Even from casting, I was like, everything is wrong. The house is wrong. So I guess I had this producer brain from the beginning where I was like, all of this was mismanaged.
I want to talk about psych degree for a moment, though. Like, that's to make a shift from that to acting and writing and all of this kind of filmmaking stuff. That's a big shift. But what was then your decision to go into psych and do that to begin with?
So I've always been fascinated by human behavior. I've always found social psychology and even child developmental psychology extremely interesting. So I just wanted to explore human nature, which is what I guess acting is actually. So I really enjoyed studying psychology, but I'm too much of an empath. And so the actual practice of becoming a psychologist didn't really interest me in the end. And I don't have this big math brain. So, 2 years of doing statistics and neuroscience was a bit of a shock to the system, but I got through it. So that was I was very proud of myself for finishing my degree. But I knew in second year that I wasn't going to become a clinical psychologist, but I did love learning about it. And so I'd always had this drive in storytelling, and I was very creative person. And so I was just too scared basically to give it a full go because I came from a migrant background where the focus was survival and the focus was be academic, support yourself financially, and then you'll have a good life. And so my parents, with so much love, just didn't understand how moving into a creative space could be a viable living future. So that's why I never fully pursued it, just because I didn't have that courage. And then with the degree behind my back, I think I felt a little bit more confident, and I took a gap year, as a lot of people do, burnt out of university. And I was in Scotland. I went on this impulse trip to Scotland, and Scotland's like my second home. It's my soul country. And every time I visit, like, I have this big life epiphany. I was in Edinburgh, and it was kind of funny because I wasn't there for the fringe, but it's a very cultural city and there's a lot of art and a lot of theatre and quite respected over there. And so just that energy was really intoxicating. And I remember being on this pub crawl, I was like 23, and this massive Scottish man, he was 7'7", honestly, like he was like two heads taller than me, leading the pub crawl in a kilt. We're all a bit messy because it was the end of the night. We're in this basement pub, and I don't know why, but it's like he got low-key possessed or something, and he got very serious and he grabbed me on my face and he was like, what do you want to do with your life? And I was just like, and then he was like, no, like, what do you want to do? And then I got really serious because he was really serious, and I was like, I just want to act. And then he was like, well, fucking do it. And then I was like, I will. And then I came home and I dropped out of my master's of commerce and applied for NIDA. And one moment changed my whole life.
I mean, Scotland will do that to you, right? Like, it's a pretty beautiful place.
It really is.
I went there in 2006 with my grandfather, who's from Scotland, and we did a lot of driving around. And you have those kinds of special epiphany moments and you really don't know where they're going to pop up.
Absolutely.
Where it might be a stranger, it might be, you know, the sights and stuff. So then you decide that you're going to audition for NIDA, which in itself is like such a, like NIDA, Whopper, like all these places are big places.
They are.
How did you prepare yourself? What kind of process did you go through for your audition for NIDA?
So I decided to do the Diploma of Stage and Screen as opposed to the 3-year bachelor, just because at that point I was a little bit burnt out of academic studies. And I thought a 1-year would be a really good like bridging transition to see, like I knew I wanted to do it and I knew that I'm very like, once I've committed my mind to something, I don't do things in halves. I'm like, it's either a yes or a no. So I knew it would work eventually, but it was kind of like a test in the waters to see how it would go. And I always enjoyed studying Shakespeare. So it was, and I'm a big history buff. So some of my electives, I'm a very random human. I'm a Gemini. So I have all these random interests of like natural disasters, geography, history. So I read a lot and watch a lot of documentaries. And so I was just like, okay, Shakespeare is not easy, but I understand what I'm saying in my text. And I'm very passionate about this monologue. I think I did Ophelia's Hamlet, one of her pieces. And I just got the crazy, like, cause she's not even crazy. She's just a mass of her situation compiled into undernurturing and repression. So I maybe having that psych degree really helped me understand character in an authentic way. And my modern piece was a political rant about Iraq and the whole US administration. And I don't know, I think I was just able to be free because maybe half of me was like, this is my destiny. And then the other half was just like, well, you know, if they reject me, it's okay. I've got something to fall back onto, and they must have seen something in my work that they liked, or I'm a very collaborative person. And I know they, in the audition process, gave us a lot of group tasks to do, see how we would work as an ensemble. And I do think that also is what helped me get in, because I'm a team player. I'm able to, I like improvisation. And I think when they were doing those exercises, they were able to see that I wasn't trying to like take people down or, you know, be the center of attention. I was quite happy to be in this collective.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Like, obviously, art and theatre is a very collaborative experience. People in front of the camera or on the stage alongside the people behind the scenes. You have to be a good person.
Absolutely.
In being able to just talk with people, right?
And be nice. Like,
yeah.
I learned very early on, you have to share. That's why I'm so grateful to Mariana and Damien, the team that came on board, because without them, this film wouldn't be where it is or what it is. And I very quickly, when I wrote it originally, the original script, I knew I didn't want to direct and act, because for me personally, I just thought I'd be too stretched. So I was like, why would I want to have that ego boost? I can have someone else who can do it and bring a whole new lens to the film and make it better with collaboration. So, yeah.
Yeah, sticking with NIDA for a moment, what other kind of experiences or moments of learning have really stuck out for you as like a pivotal thing of your creative journey that you had there?
I think building a really safe space for yourself outside of the industry mentally, because I actually didn't get any agent offers coming out of NIDA. We were the first year to be a part of this DSSP course. So we were a guinea pig year. Not even the heads of department at NIDA knew how this would go. Not many agents came to our showcase. So it wasn't just me who wasn't rep that year. It was just a bit of a potluck, to be honest. And so as someone who's a very goal-oriented, let's say, achiever through traditional means of like you study, you get good marks, it's rewarded, that was a really hard blow to process. So I'd worked so hard at NIDA, worked really hard to open myself up, to learn all these skills. I loved improvisation and I love physical theatre. So I love using the body to get into a space as opposed to trying to recall a memory. I mean, obviously a little bit of Meisner can really enhance a scene, but I think if you're constantly drawing on your trauma, it's not super healthy. And so I loved those techniques that I got to learn at drama school. And then I was just like so naive and so ready to pop out and blow up as every act actor is. And then that was a real rude awakening for me. So I think the biggest lesson actually came after drama school, where you're quite sheltered and you're built up to, it is a competitive environment, but it's competitive in a different way to maybe like a traditional like race, for example. But everyone does assume, because, you know, you work so hard to get in, it's a selective school, that everyone's just going to blow up and make it. And then that's not the reality at all. And so much of your worth, to the industry is determined by how you look or if you fit an arc. And it was really upsetting for me to come to that realization that hard work isn't equated with success in this industry necessarily, or a traditional trajectory, I guess, for acting. So I did spiral a little bit, but I'm not a quitter. So I was kind of like, had my 2 weeks of being sad. And then I was like, all right, I'll apply to a bunch of agents, and then didn't hear back from many of them. And then went, oh, well, I'll just go traveling for 2 years and just see what comes out of that and what reflections I form as a human. Because I also know I'm very big that I'm like, you are your tools. So if my tool isn't working right now to the industry, I'm very pragmatic. This is probably my psych brain coming in. But I go, okay, well, and it's probably super not healthy either that I was like, okay, then I'm the problem. How can I fix the product? But I analyzed myself objectively and I was like, okay, well, you are yourself. That's what the product is. So I'm just going to enhance myself and go travel and live my life then for a bit. And that's what I did. I moved to England and I was there for a year traveling. And then I actually started booking work in the UK and COVID came home. COVID hit. I got into a master's at Guildford of acting and writing. And I'd had this story develop in that meantime after drama school, because I did notice there was a lack of European representation on our screen quite dramatically. There's a very Angloed version of the white Australian, and then rightly so, we're getting some more representation with people of colour. But there wasn't any real European story. And I noticed any kind of European representation was generally in a comedic light, like Wog Boys, for example. So I just wanted to write something authentic. And I think from that pain of not being seen, Unspoken was born.
And you did other writing as well, like theatre plays and stuff. But I want to touch on that notion of certain types of European stories for a moment, because from my experience, at least, I talk to a lot of Australian filmmakers and they are influenced by European filmmakers, often more like French or Italian filmmakers rather than, you know, Greek filmmakers or anybody outside of those two kind of main creative spheres, I guess is the best way of putting it. And yet the representation, as you're saying, on screen is often so comedic or periphery or not really given an in-depth focus. So that push to have it on screen is so vitally important, but it's also as if you're almost writing a new text about how you present these stories on screen.
Absolutely.
So how did you go about that?
I wanted an authentic piece of work. So I didn't want a comedy that was making fun of the experience. And humor is great. Humor has a time and a purpose. And it's obviously, there's maybe little fragments of comedy in it. You have to have a bit of light and dark, but I just wanted something that was almost ugly in a sense. You know, it wasn't sugarcoating the story and it was just playing truth to, and my background's Croatian, so Croatian Slovenian. And so I just wanted a truthful representation on screen of a certain glimmer or a little pocket of the migrant experience from my perspective. And I really wanted to honor that because obviously, like, I hadn't seen that, but I just also know about generational trauma. My own experience wasn't without, you know, a little bit of light bullying for being my heritage. So I just was sick of being told I was just a white girl, or, you know, that my casting was, yeah, I like literally got told at drama school my casting was white girl number 5. And I was like, I'm more layered than that. And that's not representative of me. And I just was getting fed up with this disconnect. So I just thought, if the industry doesn't see me for who I am, I'll just write something that portrays a part of me.
I want to talk about family for a moment as well. And not to put it onto me for a second, but when I was at high school, I had a Croatian friend and he lived a few streets away from me. So we would walk home from school and always he'd be like, oh, my mum's going to be making dinner. Would you like dinner? I'm like, it's 4 o'clock. So I'd go and have dinner with him and his family and just get to experience all of that. And then I'd come home and have dinner again at my place.
Yeah.
But this sense of family, again, is like the way people live with their family is so different and unique. And yet we're getting to see that in such an intimate way in Unspoken. Mm. How important is it to present family in this way on screen?
I think it's huge, particularly if you're looking at the Australian Croatian community, because we're definitely a little group. Like we're a small migrant population and we, I think, get absorbed sometimes into the Greek or the Italian experience, which is similar, but not 100%, you know, the same experience. I think, you know, when you've got a much bigger population migrating, there's a bit more support. And also there was a very different viewpoint in how Croatians were viewed versus Italian or Greek migrants. Just due to the political nature of Yugoslavia and that whole political unrest over there. So I think when, you know, I don't know what life was like in the 70s, but my dad was in his 20s when he was in the 70s. He's the same age as Mariana's father. My dad was a bit older when he had me. But he was, you know, profusely bullied coming to Australia. And, you know, they were called like bomb throwers and, you know, seen as terrorists essentially, and a very hostile, unsafe community because of that whole Croatian Six scandal that happened in the late 70s, 80s that I wasn't actually originally aware of. I knew there was a lot of discrimination about the community and that my dad had been really bullied from those like xenophobic viewpoints. But when I met Mariana, the producer, she just opened up the world and she was like, this is what happened. And this is why the community was so tainted. And that just made so much sense to me. And I was like, wow, you know, it's really, she was very adamant that it's very important that we include that too, because it shaped a whole generation of Croatian Australians. And then it was funny because we were talking about, she grew up very proud, being very, very proud of her heritage, where I was the opposite in the 90s, I guess. And we were talking about the Howard government and how his migration policies may have affected this. But I was very ashamed of my heritage. You know, I didn't want my parents speaking. I mean, my mom speaks Slovenian, my dad speaks Croatian. They're different but similar. So I couldn't tell you which was which, to be honest. But there's a jumble in my brain. But I just remember being very embarrassed when they spoke Croatian out loud in public. And I just wanted to blend and fit in. And I already had the Wog name and the dark hair. And my siblings are fairer. They're like tan and blonde. So I'm like the black sheep. And I just felt very different. And so it was funny, there was like a lot of shame around heritage as opposed to pride. And I think that within the Croatian community is mixed, but because we are a smaller group, most of us probably wanted to assimilate. And it was similar to like the German population that came out here. They assimilated pretty easily versus the Italians and the Greeks were very proud and they're happy to hold their culture. So that was also a very unique nuance, I think, in the Croatian community that I wanted to share.
Yeah, I find that that kind of the lingering of stories through time as well is something that's really quite important to you. You're talking about your dad being around in his 20s, around the late 70s, early 80s. Did he talk about these kinds of stories, what was happening at the time?
A little bit. Like I remember, I think the biggest generational trauma he's passed on to us was me thinking I was different, that I wasn't actually Australian. So I actually did not know I was Australian until I was probably like 8 years old, seven, eight, maybe six when I started primary school. I would just say I'm Croatian. Like that's how much of a distinction that I guess my dad had in his identity, not feeling a fully a part of Australian culture or like accepted by the Aussies is what he would call it. So there was a lot of that projected onto me that I didn't even know. And so, yeah, I like literally grew up thinking I was Croatian, not Australian. And then, just feeling very different, feeling out of place, but then not fully accepted by the Croatian community either. I remember my sister and I, who are 2 years apart, hated going to the Croatian club, and we hated going and interacting with the Croatian kids because they saw us as outsiders because we were too assimilated. Because my mum, even though she's a Slovenian background, she grew up in Sydney. So I grew up in Wollongong, which is a much smaller regional place and has much more, we'll say, like, was less open-minded than a place like Sydney would have been, which had a much higher, like, even though Wollongong had a very high European migrant population, there was a big distinction between the migrants who came to Wollongong and the Australian Aussies that lived there. So it was a huge, like, class distinction. There was a huge power imbalance because my dad used to work for the steelworks, and he said that, and my granddad did too, all the Aussies had all the managerial jobs and all the Wogs had the worker jobs. So there was this huge imbalance of power, where in Sydney, maybe a lot of migrants obviously got to escape that because it's a metropolitan city and they could clump together and support themselves. So my mum didn't grow up with these views of, like, I feel different or inferior, but my dad definitely did. And so we were raised very Aussie. So I was sort of in this place of growing up feeling very confused and very fish out of water in both sides, until I decided, well, I'm just going to join the Aussies.
Thinking about it in, like, a contrast sense to America, I guess, where people will say, you know, I'm Italian American or I'm Irish American or whatever, and they might be an eighth generation American, and it's,
yeah,
like, I think you know, but this, and there's this level of pride there, right? But mm-hmm. in Australia, certainly white Australians really did a really terrible thing of pushing people down, like you were saying. You know, no, Australian culture is the dominant culture, you just have to blend in, otherwise mm-hmm. you know, be gone. And those things, like, we're in 2025 and that still is a thing. It's still active. It's terrible, really, really terrible.
Yeah. And I think that's why Unspoken is such a universal story, because it's shot through the lens of a Croatian experience, but really it's universal to any migrant group that comes to a new place. And it's always battling those themes of belonging, discrimination. Do you assimilate? Do you hold your culture? And often if you're coming from a war-torn country, which is what, you know, the Nedic family in the film escaped, and that's what happened to my family, you know, you've got war trauma and you've got, you know, you're not fleeing a country because you dislike it. You're fleeing a country for survival and safety. And so there's all those themes that are going on that migrants struggle with that often get overlooked. Or there's, like, a language barrier, so they're just assumed as stupid or incompetent, and, you know, they'll just take the easy jobs.
Let's talk about, you're talking about safety, which is a big thing, mm-hmm. but it's the safety of creativity as well is really important. So when you're creating the script like Unspoken, and you bring it to people like Damien and Mariana, and you're talking to them about, this is what I've got, can you help me bring it to life? What's that process like? How do you feel going through that process?
So originally I tried writing Unspoken, which the original title was Hidden Behind the Flame Tree, as a screenplay, a full feature. But I decided that I'd worked on film sets, some indie film sets, as, like, a production coordinator and a PA. And I kind of learned what works and what doesn't work. So all my producing training is taught on the job or through Google. I don't have formal producer training. I knew I was a good writer because I had done my psych degree, and also I did well at school with English. And then I found myself as a freelance writer in the UK for a little bit, working for, like, Screen Rant, and did a bit of work for this charity up in Glasgow. So I knew I could write and I knew I had a story. So I wrote it in COVID because I came back kind of not fully consensual to that, in the sense that I didn't want to leave the UK. You know, I was supposed to start drama school and my whole life just got tipped upside down because of COVID. But obviously survival is more important. You know, I was like, I can't starve in England. So I came home, and instead of spiraling, I was like, you know what? I've been brought here for a reason. I have this Australian story in my head. I'm just going to write what I can manage, and I can shape this screenplay that I've been working on for 2 years into a short film. And I know I can do that well. So I was very confident that I'd be able to pull something that I respected out. And so when I wrote it, I'd had the idea in my head for 2 years, but I did write it in 3 days. And then I remember coming into my mom's room and I was like, my whole life's going to change. I just had this feeling that like something was cooking, and I'm very spiritual. So I get these like drop-ins. And then I approached my co-producer / one of my best friends, Maddie Barlow. She did the costumes on the film. And she wasn't working during that time either. And she was, I sent her the script and I was like, do you want to work on this with me? I met her at NIDA and she was like, I love the script. The script didn't have a political nature at that point. It was more about the belonging, assimilation, family dynamics, and how one works within that framework of that, dating an Australian man and how do you introduce to family and all the complexities about that, and the discrimination more so. There was no political storyline just yet, but the world was very much there in the sense of like those undertones of, you know, hate. And then I approached Maddie, she loved the script. And then I essentially did most of the initial pre-production with her. And then we got to the point of casting. And we did an online scout because there are no Croatian actors, basically, apart from Eric Banner, who's half Croatian. And I think there's like one or two other random Australian Croatian actors, but they all actually launched their careers in the US. So I wasn't even sure if they were in Australia. I knew I needed Croatian speaking actors as well, because to authentically portray it, because it was very important to me that this film was bilingual. I really wanted to show that, because there is no migrant experience without dual language. It just doesn't exist. Even me, who rejected speaking Croatian, I call it survival Croatian, can still understand a part of it and like speak a little bit. So I'm like, it just doesn't exist. It needs to be there for it to be authentic. So I need Croatian speakers. And so I just did this mass online search in the hope that someone, even if they were an actor, would come out and be able to fulfill the role, because I was particularly looking for the dad, because the whole dynamic is about the father-daughter relationship as well, and the power dynamics regarding like even how women are treated versus men. And negating that in the 70s. And I don't know why I was drawn to the 70s, but I just knew that this was probably one of the most heated decades for Australian Croatians. And I just felt very drawn to that era. So I was like, okay, I'm going to set it in this era. And then in casting, I met Mariana. So she just blew my mind. I fell completely in love with her in her audition. And it was funny because I remember she was blonde and I was just like, oh, damn it, like, you know, it doesn't look wog enough for me. So I wasn't expecting to really cast her at all. And, you know, her capability was just so amazing. And she was so natural and she took direction really well. And she was so lovely. And I was just like, oh my God, this is her. And then because she's such a prominent figure in the Croatian community, she just had all these contacts and knew everyone. And her father actually knew the original Croatian six men who were arrested for crimes that they didn't commit. It's the most successful espionage story in the whole Cold War, in my opinion. So she had this personal knowledge. She's a journalist, her background. And so it was just a no-brainer to include her into the writing process. And I just asked her after we had another director originally attached and it just wasn't in alignment. She didn't understand the vision or the story, and, you know, these creative differences can happen. And it was a respectful ending, but it just got to the point where I politely said, like, this is the core of the story. And if we can't work around that, then it's not going to work. Like, we can't keep shape shifting this to try fit a vision you're trying to mold. It has to be in line with this vision that I've seen for the film. And so we decided to part ways. And then I think everything happens for a reason, because that's when Damien came on board. But after that fracture, I asked Mariana if she wanted to join in the writing process and come on board as a producer, because she was already just organically kind of heading that way anyway. And she accepted, and the film just kind of, yeah, like slowly dominoed on itself and just got bigger and bigger. And that was fantastic. And so Mariana injected this whole political element to the film, which gives it that tempo and that pace. And it makes it immediate, because I think my original script was, it was more of a slow burn, because I love like A24 style films, and it was more about the family. But then when you put it with this political current, it just explodes on screen. And so ironically, we reviewed as bomb throwers. but yeah, it was just a bit of magic that came together. And then when we met Damien, he just is such an artist, and he was able to elevate it even further and take the family and the political world and just really, really ramp the energy up and the pacing and the dialogue. And, you know, he's a wizard at script writing. So he came and he cleaned it all up with, we did this writer's retreat, the three of us together, and then it became the piece you see today.
I think, I mean, again, I think it's such a powerful, powerful film. A lot of it centers on your performance too. And I think one of, you're talking about the political background of it and everything that's going on there, the tension that's going on there. But I think the key scene for me that really polarizes it is we've got all of that going on, and we know that that's going on. And then there's just a scene where you're having a shower and you're by yourself, right? And we can already tell what you're thinking, because it's almost like the shower or the, you know, the toilet or the bathroom is like the one place that you can have peace.
Yeah.
The one place that you can stop and just think for yourself and go, nobody's intruding here. Nobody's like interrupting my thoughts. Can you talk about the need to have that polarizing thing of the sanctuary versus what else is going on?
Well, it's funny because that scene was in my original script, the bathroom scene, and it was just, I've wanted a moment of stillness and vulnerability for Marina. So Marina is an offshoot of me. I call her my broken side. So ironically, I found myself in this process. I did a lot of healing and accepting of myself and my heritage. So now I'm very proud to be who I am. And Marina gave me that gift. But Marina is an offshoot of me. And I just remember myself in times where I just felt so overwhelmed by the world, very pulled, fish out of water. And I just, you know, the shower is a safe space, like you said. And I think there's such a vulnerability when you're naked in a shower and you just get to sit with yourself and be. And so I just thought that was such a pivotal moment to just give the film a bit of stillness when everything else is so fast. And Damien, when he read the original script, that was his favorite scene as well. So he was like, we definitely need to keep that and honor that. And, you know, I think it shows the character's internal world, where a lot of the film you see today is very fast and it's very about the outer, but that's a moment of still on the inner, where you get to see that she is a complex, nuanced person who, even though I think a lot of us put up a good front, no one's that strong, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So tell me about working with Damien. What kind of director is he?
Oh, he's brilliant. He is such a gentle, nurturing director. He's very generous. He's very much play yourself, which I like. You know, obviously you need to understand your circumstances and your motives, I guess, within character. But I just love the freedom he gives actors. You know, he's not like it has to be a word perfect portrayal. You just have to be real. So in order to be real, you just need to play yourself, and you need to deal with the other person who's working against you. And so, you know, he was very easy to work with. I felt very safe on set with him, very much trusted his lens, his vision. So it was beautiful. When we were actually shooting, I wasn't producing at all. I just got to be an actor. And I think that was such a privilege, honestly, because then my work is focused solely on the character. It's not, oh, did catering get picked up, or, you know, this or that. And so that was such a gift he gave me. And then I remember there was one moment where I had one little fracture where I was out of character and struggling to get back in because I'd been triggered by my family who'd come on set, and they don't mean to do that. But anyway, so I was just a bit self-conscious, I guess, and struggling to get back in. And this was during the house scene that we'd been shooting for 2 days, and it was so intense. And I remember Damien could tell I was out of it. And so he just, you know, pulled us aside, and he pulled, you know, each and every one actor when we all had our little moments of connection, trying to get back into character. And he would just, you know, have a little chat and just be like checking in, and then, you know, just kind of give you this little pep talk that just helps you relax. Because I think about acting as, in order to be authentic and vulnerable, you have to feel safe. So if you don't feel safe in front of your actors, your crew, or your director, you're not going to actually be able to open up to have that layer of depth and vulnerability where people connect with. And then that's when I think an audience can instantly go, oh, that's a bad actor, or that's an inauthentic performance. Like, even if you can't fully pinpoint what it is about the performance, you can tell there's a disconnect. And so with Damien, I fully trusted him, and I felt very safe. And in those moments of softness where he'd be like, you know, it's okay, or I can't even remember what he said to me, but, you know, like, just even taking space to just check in meant a lot. And then he'd give us these exercises to get us out of our heads. So Matt, who played my on-screen boyfriend, and I would be constantly doing this like double, double, this, this, that thing. And it just makes it silly, and you're focusing on getting the sequence correct, that you're not thinking and you're back in your body. So I think Damien was a brilliant director because he was very gentle, very patient, had a very clear vision of what he wanted to, but he also gave you freedom and flexibility as an actor to try new things and to get them wrong and feel safe to fall, essentially, and then get you back into your body if you were struggling to connect.
We're talking about vulnerability and your parents being there. What's that vulnerability feel like when you present them the final film?
My parents are very proud of me. So I guess it was, my dad didn't want to see the finished product until the premiere at Flickerfest. So that was really interesting because I didn't get to see his reaction. I think my mum started crying. She was very proud of me, and she saw, I guess, an authentic portrayal, even though she's Slovenian, she's not Croatian, authentic migrant story. And I think that really touched her. And I think because the whole process was 3 years from finish to end, you know, she saw everything. She saw the, you know, me trying to raise funds. The film almost never got made several times. And I was sort of the glue that kept it all together. You know, at one point, this person might pull out, or this person's now unavailable, or we don't have enough money. And if I don't get this much money, you know, I can't do what I need. And so it was my baby. And I guess I was really the one person. I mean, obviously Damien and Mariana of, you know, very integral too, but I guess I was really that one tether that held the fort going when, you know, the ashes were just embers, and then I'm there with the fire trying to like flame it up again. I really was that one follow through, and she saw all of that. And I say producing is predominantly people management at the end of the day, and keeping everyone happy and their spirits up. And that's something that I had to do for 3 years. So after the film, I had major burnout.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. Even, you know, though, that, you know, it's probably a very healthy set overall and experience. You know, there's always a lot of strain in the film world, and, you know, managing that for 3 years. And so I think she was just so proud of me that I was able to physically do it and have a product at the end of the day, because so many people try and don't end up making a film. So I think that's what she was most proud of.
You're talking about that burnout notion as well. How do you physically and mentally step yourself down from that? Like, in the past, you would have gone, overseas and had a bit of a time to digest. But now, is that still something you do, or how else do you find a way of easing yourself out of that?
Yeah. I think, what did I do? I stopped writing for a long time. I'm going to be completely honest. I creatively was a little bit zapped, but also I was working full time, studying a master's of writing, doing acting coursework. So I was doing too much. I prefer to be busy than not busy, but I think I'd really overloaded myself, especially in that last 12 months. And so I just kind of did nothing. I just did a lot of TLC, went back to just very simple things. Like I started The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron and just really just took time for myself. And, you know, everyone was like, what's next? And, you know, which are you going to bounce to a bigger agent or are you going to do this? And I was like, I just don't care. I was like, I just need to sit with myself for some time and slow the tempo down. So even though I didn't move anywhere or travel, I just creatively had a little pause for a month or two. And then last year, I actually took 4 months off to travel. but my back gave way. I slipped my L4.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so I guess there was a lot of physical pressure that I put on my body too. So my body actually forced me to slow down.
And it'll do that, right? Like we might not mentally know it, but physically it's like, hang on, you're doing a lot. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So it actually took me out of work for 4 months. I was on workers comp. So yeah, I had no choice but to just sit.
Yeah.
And then after having some time to just relax, I've started writing a new screenplay. So right. It's come back. But yeah, I think if in hindsight, upon reflection, sharing, it's not like just necessarily like task workload, but sharing mental workload is important as well. And that is something I'm grateful for Mariana and Damien. They were such, you know, we were a tent, a fort, like really held each other up. But I think also just sharing that and maybe taking on a little bit less in future projects just to have more of a work-life balance. Yeah.
You're heading to St Kilda, which is fantastic. Yeah. What does it mean to be able to screen it there? And you're heading down as well. What's that going to be like for you? What are you looking forward to about it?
I'm really excited. St Kilda is a great film festival, as we know. I think it's great that we get to play in a major, like we've played in Perth, we've played in Adelaide and Sydney, but to also play in Melbourne now, it's sort of like the final bit of the cake that gets eaten, which is great. I think it's there's such a beautiful migrant population down there, so I think it's a privilege that we get to share the story down in Melbourne, which is a very open, accepting city. And yeah, it's just kind of, for me, the final major city that we get to tick off. And so yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Hopefully it's received well.
Certain it will be. Yeah.
Yeah, I get some people talking. Yeah. So
I completely forgot to ask as well, because I know it won at the Clermont Ferrand Film Festival, which is like,
yes.
So let's close on that, because that's phenomenal, yeah, yeah. Right? That is absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah, I can chat for a little bit.
I forgot to ask about that one thing, which is so important. Yeah. What does that mean? Yeah.
Well, it means we're Oscar eligible. So we won the International Grand Prix, which was insane. Yeah. That was a whirlwind experience, very surreal. You know, to even get into the festival is huge. There's nearly 10,000 entries around the world and they only accept 62. And then to win out of those 62 exceptional films is just such a privilege, such a beyond honor that I think both Mariana and myself were in shock. I know Mariana actually was. It's funny. She's this really loud, charismatic person. And I remember when I clocked we won, when they announced the second last prize of the night, because the international category is considered the most prestigious in the film festival too. So essentially like the runner up, they didn't announce us. And I was like, oh my God, we've just won it. And the panel was on the stage and I remember one of the judges looking at me and he couldn't hide his excitement. So he was literally like, and turned away from me. And I was like, we've won.
Yeah.
And I go to Mariana. I'm like, Mariana, I think we won. And she blanked me. She was just like in complete shock. Like she just shut down. It was so funny. She was like, I'd never seen her like ever in that state of shutdown and just not able to process. And unfortunately, Damien had to fly back to Australia, so he wasn't able to be there for the closing ceremony. But it was so surreal. And the best part of it was actually just watching the French come and support film and short film particularly, because obviously there is a bit of a, you know, a misconception with short films that they're a bit amateur or not worthy of recognition because they're a small medium versus like a feature film, for example. But to see the support was insane. And, you know, people would be lining up behind the cinema for hours. And I'm talking thousands of people to see a short film set. And it was just so beautiful how much the French support film and creatives. And I think that's something, you know, hopefully Australia can increase. You know, we have such a beautiful pool of talent here, and I think it really gets overlooked.
Well, definitely. I mean, it's the one festival where I'm like, I don't really look at too many international film festivals and say, I want to go there. But that's the one festival I'm like, I would love to go and just absorb all of those films. Because shorts, I think, as you're saying, like, there's this notion that they're amateurish. And it's like, they're not. Like, some of the very best films that have ever been made are short films, right? And, like, people will talk about, you know, all these different ones, and then they go, oh, but we just disregard it. It's like, no. What people are putting on screen, sometimes it leans into a short format. And I can see Unspoken being pulled out into a feature film, but digesting it into a shorter format, it just really compacts that intensity as well and makes it an even more impactful film, because it's like, wow, this is tight. Like, it's just, yeah.
Absolutely. And actually distilling a film to put it into a short film format is really difficult. Almost easier to make a feature film because you have time to create stories and arcs and get audiences to connect with a character. And so to be able to successfully do that in a short time is quite an achievement. So I think that really gets underlooked with short films. And when we were there, it was amazing because, you know, we got to see so many films from around the world that had achieved this, that were able to capture you in such a short amount of time, and, you know, and just to express this micro pocket of life from everywhere. It was fantastic.
Thanks for listening to this chat with Kat Dominus. Her film Unspoken is screening at St Kilda Film Festival on the 7th of June. Stick a link in the show notes to purchase tickets. For other interviews and reviews, visit thecurb.com.au. Please rate, review and share this interview with your film-loving friends. We hope they like it as much as you have. I'll see you on the next one.